Grace and peace to each and every one of you today. I am Captain Roger McCourt from the Salvation Army in Grass Valley, California. Thank you very much for joining us for our worship and study time online. Hey, do you ever watch any of those syndicated talk shows like Maury or Steve Wilkos or anything like that? No, don't raise your hand. You're right. That's probably something you're embarrassed to admit in public. But that kind of show turned into the reality TV explosion, which still dominates the channelscape today. And these shows are successful for exactly this reason. Relationships are complicated. And we get some kind of vicarious thrill out of seeing that the relationships that drive us crazy in our lives are even a little tiny bit more reasonable or sensible than the ones that we're watching. When what is broken somewhere else seems to be more broken than what we are living out, we somehow feel as if we don't need to do anything to clean up our mess. Bad news? Other people's bad behavior is no excuse for your own. So seeing how messed up things can get should do exactly the opposite in our lives. It should make us realize that we need to work to restore the relationships and the people around us now, rather than waiting for them to spiral so far out of control that someone makes a TV show where you are the star. Now, we're going to go through Acts chapter 24 today, and I'll be reading from the New International Version, but you can read from another translation if that works better for you. The words might be different, but the meaning behind them should still be the same. Before we do this, though, let me introduce you to one of the characters who is at the center of our passage today, Felix. Back in the first century in Rome, Felix and his older brother Paulus were born as slaves who were attached to the household of Antonia, who was a niece of Caesar Augustus and daughter of Mark Antony. Now, for reasons left behind in the dustbin of history, they were set free under her patronage, and following Roman customs of the day, they each added her name to their own. Paulus became Marcus Antonius Paulus, and he was still under the patronage of the household when Antonius' son Claudius became emperor. Still, he was a freed slave, and when Claudius made him secretary of the treasury of the empire, there was a lot of opposition at first, but Paulus excelled at the job, and he was apparently honest, too. He made himself and the empire much, much richer while he was in that position, and it wasn't long before he began to wield this immense power and influence over the affairs of Rome, and he stayed in his position until the next emperor, Nero, released him from the job in the year 55. Paulus, it seems, was a close political ally of Julia Agrippa, who was Nero's mother, but Nero was trying to get out from under her influence, especially as rumors that she was the one who assassinated Claudius swirled around. You think your family's a mess. Now, even out of office, Paulus was one of the wealthiest men in the world, and he remained a power broker until 62 AD, when Nero had him killed and took possession of most of the money by using his power as Paulus's patron to legally inherit it. It's like an episode of Real Housewives of Ancient Rome. Now, meanwhile, Paulus's brother Felix had become Antonius Felix, though some historians called him Claudius Felix because he was part of the house of Claudius. Paulus's influence kept him climbing the imperial ladder, but Felix seemed to be a favorite of the ruling household as well. But it was a request made by a Jewish priest that brought Felix into the most important position of being governor over Judea. That priest's name was Jonathan, and he was in Rome to complain about the current proconsul, a guy named Cumanus, whose brutal handling of Jewish dissent under his rule had led to rioting and over 30,000 dead Israelites. Jonathan asked Claudius to replace Cumanus with Felix, and in 52, Claudius did. And Jonathan probably thought that would win him special favor from Felix, but it didn't. The former slave was every bit as brutal as his predecessor. In fact, in a lot of ways, more so. He was harsh, he was unyielding in his rule, and he was even more violent in his repression of those who acted against Roman interests. This even after he had married a Jewish princess named Drusilla, persuading her to leave her first husband, the priest king of Emesa, by sending Simon the sorcerer from Cyprus to persuade her of Felix's affections. This wasn't just a coup for Felix. But he didn't have to worry about keeping names straight when he married her, because his first wife's name was also Drusilla. And then there's a third wife that he came up with somewhere that historians didn't bother to preserve her name. But if she comes up again, we're going to call her Drusilla as well. All right. Now, none of this elevated Felix or his actions in the eyes of the Jewish people. Drusilla, the Jewish Drusilla, was one of the daughters of Herod Agrippa, a man who was so unpopular that national celebrations were held on the occasion of his death. His daughters were also not well regarded, and statues of them were publicly and horrifically defiled as part of those celebrations. Now, Jonathan began to complain about Felix as loudly as he had complained about Cumanus, and when Jonathan was elected to be high priest in the year 58, Felix would respond by persuading Jonathan's best friend to arrange for assassins to kill the priest. It was all done in secret, so everyone knew. Yeah, must have been on screen, right? But now, that all that last stuff, that last assassination and all that, that hasn't happened yet when the Apostle Paul was arrested and brought to Caesarea for Felix to rule on the charges brought by the Jewish leadership. It is the year 57 when Roman soldiers smuggle Paul out of Jerusalem and take him to Caesarea because of the trouble which had stirred up around him. Lysias, the military commander in Jerusalem, had seen for himself how Paul's presence seemed to attract trouble, and since Paul was a Roman citizen, he sent him to Felix to decide what to do with him, which brings us to where we are starting today, Acts 24, verse 1. And for those of you who ever thought to yourself, oh, I don't want to read the Bible, it's boring, man, you are not reading it right. All right. Acts 24, verse 1, 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. It's kind of funny. They hired a lawyer. It tells you how concerned these guys were about presenting a good case against Paul. These men, they're all important public figures in their own right. They're all public speakers. They're used to presenting arguments in high-pressure situations. But even they hired a professional to lead them as they brought their charges before the governor. Why? Because Paul has shown himself to be so good at all kinds of rhetoric, they're afraid to face him. So they got Tertullus. Now, we don't have any outside knowledge about him, but he must have been good for these guys to hire him. We know that he's got skills, we know that he was well trained, and we can see from what he says and how he does it that he is at least familiar with Jewish law and Roman law. It is likely he has presented cases to Proconsul Felix before and that they had gone well, or he wouldn't have been the speaker that these guys chose. Y'all with me? Right. We're going to go to verse 2. And in fact, I'm going to read a whole little block here, verses 2 through 9. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. Before Felix. Oh my goodness. Let me start that over. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect, and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. And then verse 9 says, the other Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. This is a brilliant and smooth argument from beginning to end. Tertullus opens with flattery of the judge, which was standard, and he does a very good job of it. And then he deftly changes the charges against Paul from being entirely religious in nature to being a very directed argument that Paul is committing sedition against the Roman Empire. He begins by calling Paul, well, the NIV says a troublemaker, but a direct translation is actually, he's a plague. He is a plague that is traveling around the empire trying to get Jews to riot. And then they say, well, he's not really Jewish because he's joined this cultish splinter group. And he outright attacked the temple too. And then the masterstroke is this assertion that these Jewish leaders had him seized, and the implication is that they did so intending to bring him to Roman authorities because he is challenging the Roman Empire. Every charge is very much one of this rebellion against Rome, stirring up riots. That's creating or trying to create a rebellion. Being part of an unauthorized religious group, that is against Roman law. Attacking the temple? You're interfering with Roman-approved local culture. Now, after he presents his case, Tertullus has the various opponents of Paul present their accusations, as if their accusations are somehow confirming evidence that his statements were true. And then it was Paul's turn to respond. Verse 10. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I will gladly make my defense. I love this because Paul just doesn't even bother to sugarcoat his introduction like Tertullus did. Even though everyone knew that Felix was a guy who loved himself, frankly. But Paul just acknowledges, you know, Felix, you've been in this role for some time, which is true. He's been there for about 5 years at this point. And then Paul's like, you know, I'm prepared to address the charges as they're laid out. Verses 11 and 12, Paul goes on. He says, you can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone in the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogue or anywhere else in the city. So Paul's beginning by confronting this charge of sedition, and he points out he'd only been in the city just over a week, not enough time to do the things that his opponents were suggesting, and he wasn't arguing with anyone or speaking to a crowd in the temple or any other place when they came to take him in. Now, he did speak to the crowd afterwards, but I notice he doesn't bring that up either. He's just saying, look, when they came to get me, all I was doing was a little worship. Verse 13. They can't prove to you the charges they're now making against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our ancestors as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God that these men themselves had, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. So what's Paul saying? He's saying, look, they can't prove any charge that I was disturbing the peace or that I was doing anything wrong in the temple, but I am a follower of the way. These guys say it's a splinter fringe group, but we worship the same God. We believe in the same law, the same prophets. We have the same expectation based on what's taught there. Resurrection. So I work to make sure that I'm ready for that when it happens. Nothing fringe or separate about any of that. And I have to live in a way that is good in the eyes of God and in the eyes of those around me. And Paul's not done yet. What he's doing is he's setting up a refutation of all their charges. Look at verses 17 and 18. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. So he's saying, look, there's no sedition, there's no rebellion, there's not even a disturbance or an argument. I'm just a guy who was engaged in traditional Jewish almsgiving, sacrifices, and worship, stuff like that. Paul is correctly assuming that Felix will have an understanding of this, or that Drusilla, who is sitting right beside him, will be able to explain how these are regular practices of the Jewish people. They're not fringe behaviors. And then Paul wraps his defense up in verses 19 to 21. He says, but there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. Unless it was this one thing that I shouted as I stood in their presence, it is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. Now, this argument really, by itself, could just end the trial and get Paul dismissed. All of the main charges against him were originally made by his opponents from Ephesus, none of whom were here. Now, under Roman law, this meant that they had abandoned whatever charges they made, and that was a big deal. You weren't allowed to just go around making accusations that you wouldn't or couldn't back up. And Paul points out that the accusers who had come would only be able to testify about their theological argument. They couldn't present any charges from the meeting of the Sanhedrin because the Sanhedrin never found him guilty of anything. Dr. Ben Witherington says that this was a master stroke because Paul just made his accusers into witnesses that he had only ever spoken about theological matters, absolutely nothing that should involve any Roman court. And look at verses 22 and 23. It says, "Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. When Lysias the commander comes," he said, "I will decide your case." And he ordered that the centurion keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. So Felix essentially is saying, "Oh, look, each side has asked me to examine further evidence, so I'll do that when the tribune comes from Jerusalem." And Paul is confined to effectively a minimum house arrest in the city while they wait. And where it says that Felix was acquainted with the way, the NIV is a little soft in its translation. It's more accurate and sharper to say it the way the Lexham English Bible puts it. Verse 22 from the LEB. "But Felix, because he understood the facts concerning the way more accurately, put them off, saying, 'When Lysias, the military tribune, comes down, I will decide your case.'" Now, what is it he understood about the way of Jesus more accurately than those making accusations against Paul? Well, perhaps he understood that Nazarenes weren't the troublemakers these guys are claiming them to be. The earliest followers of Jesus, they took nonviolence and showing love for their neighbors so seriously that believers would step down from military or political positions to avoid doing harm. And they went out of their way to love people, especially people who abused them. And the believers in Jerusalem followed the example of James. James was the brother of Jesus. He was the leader of the way in the city. James was a devout Jewish man. He was renowned for how he upheld the law. He prayed in the temple so often and with such fervor that he was known as Old Camel Knees because he developed calluses from kneeling on the stone floors there. And Felix, he also knew that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he, Felix, would have felt the need to uphold the rights of a citizen. And at the same time, governors in Judea, they all had to balance the demands of the Jewish leadership to try to keep them in line. More than one governor had disregarded their demands and then found his position terminated when a Caesar decided that someone else might do a better job of keeping the Jews from complaining to him. Including, remember, the one who was removed to make room for Felix. So Felix would have a special awareness of how important it is to try to balance what these guys want and what is best for empire. So when the governor declared that he would wait for Lysias to come, he's not seeking to do justice. He's playing politics. He's trying to balance the competing sides to keep his own life comfortable. Justice. Justice is really what this whole thing is about, isn't it? We've got people trying to cling to power. And when people are clinging to power, they never really seem to serve justice, do they? Well, let's ask, what is justice anyway? What is justice? Here in America, stick with me. Here in America, we abandoned the concept of justice a long time ago. I know that sounds harsh. But when you think about what justice is versus how we define it these days, you might find that you agree. When we talk about justice, we usually do so by discussing punishment. When a car gets stolen and the thief is caught, we act as if a prison sentence provides justice. That's not justice, though. That is retribution. Punishment meted out to hurt someone the amount that we believe such a crime deserves. It's a kind of aversion therapy. If you get hurt this way every time you steal a car, you should stop stealing cars, right? Because you don't want to be hurt this way anymore. We talk about things like the punishment fitting the crime, right? You've heard that. That, however, is not justice. Justice, the way it is meant whenever you run across that word in Scripture, it's about restoration. That's not just giving back the car that was taken. It means returning any lost value as well. So if you steal a car and you wreck it, that would mean not just replacing the car, but replacing anything that was lost because the car wasn't there to be used. Lost hours to work, lost time dealing with the police or insurance companies, the lost sense of security that comes from the violation of having your car taken from you. And that's still not all. Then there's the loss of community between you and the one who stole the car. Justice demands that that be restored as well. Well, how do you do that? Good question. Every situation is going to be different, won't it? How do you ever recover from a loss to the point that you and the person who caused the loss can be truly said to have a fully restored relationship? But that's what justice is. It is a restored relationship. In the law of Moses, if a sheep was stolen, the thief was required to make restitution. If they still had the stolen sheep when they got caught, they needed to give it back, plus one more to cover the value of the other losses. If the sheep was gone, whether it had been sold or killed, then the value of four sheep needed to be paid back. And once it was paid for, both parties were to behave as if the matter was done with. All right. Now, there are times and circumstances where this kind of dealing is harder to work out, but the goal was always to be the same: justice, and justice done as quickly as possible. There is no justice being rendered by Felix in this situation. Instead, he puts it off, because justice in this situation would make the injustice of some of his previous decisions so obvious it could get him fired. But when you refuse justice in one situation, it always leads to a deeper injustice. Look at verses 24 to 26. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. As Paul talked about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, "That's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you." At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. Now, Paul's message about the grace of God given through Jesus is a message of embracing justice. Justice. The Greek word is, it's a long one, hang on. You know, it's funny, you start looking at these words transliterated into English and then realize you really should have written out a pronunciation. The Greek word is dikaiosune. Dikaiosune, justice. Dikaiosune, it means to act in a fair and equitable way. It is also translated as righteousness. So when Felix sent for Paul, Paul talked about dikaiosune, the choices we make, and how a time will come when we have to give an account before a heavenly judge for those choices and actions that were on our part, right? And Felix was disturbed. He was afraid to think about what that might mean in his life, so he tried to delay justice by sending Paul away. He was trying to delude himself into believing he could wait to pursue justice when it would be convenient for him to do so. Or maybe just until Paul paid him to give the right answer, as if being paid to do the right thing somehow makes the wrong things okay. You want to know how that worked out? Look at verse 27. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So, delaying justice on that one day, Paul's justice has been delayed already for 2 more years. 2 years he sat in prison, waiting, just because Felix is trying to do a favor for these guys so that hopefully they won't have him removed. And during those 2 years, We have a new high priest. Felix has that new high priest assassinated, and then all the politics finally catch up with him, and he finds himself dismissed, replaced by Festus, who we will talk about next time. But for these 2 years, while Felix was disturbed, delayed, and deluded, we have Paul being left disenfranchised and detained. But once we determine to derail doing what is right, we are doomed, right? Instead, what we should do is act decisively to seek justice in all things. Micah chapter 6, verse 8 tells us what God wants from each one of us. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. So don't be like Felix. Instead, seek justice. Find ways to put things and people back together. You can't do that without acting in mercy and embracing humility, two things that the governor refused to do, but which we all can choose to live out if we decide to. And what we choose to do to bring about justice is ultimately what we will need to account for when the day comes that we stand before Jesus. So don't put off your opportunity to seek justice. It may not come again. Amen? Questions, comments, or thoughts? Send me an email. Post them in the comments. Do whatever. I would love to have dialogue. Come to one of our in-person meetings every Sunday morning at 11 here in Grass Valley, California. We meet at our Alta Street location, and we would love to have you with us. For right now, take this thought with you. You must seek justice, not just for yourself, but for everyone. Seek justice for all those around you. You can do it. And you can do it without fear. You know why? Because you have nothing to fear. Wherever you go, God is already there. Just go with God. Grace and peace to each and every one of you in the coming week. I'll see you next time.